Oregon's largest mass shooting took place in our region yesterday. 10 people, apparently including the shooter, died on the campus of Umpqua Community College in Roseburg. At least 7 more people were wounded. In this hour, we'll talk about the contributing factors common to school shootings to help us understand what happened, past tense. And we'll talk about what might happen in the near future to comfort students and communities and maybe improve their safety. 4 guests with us today. Joseph Lieberman on the phone is the author of School Shootings in 2008 and The Shooting Game from 2006. Joe, good to have you back on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thanks for having me. It's too bad that we have to have contact for these reasons.
Absolutely. Victor Chang, we have 3 guests with us from Southern Oregon University. Victor Chang in the studio with me is the Director of Counseling. Thank you for joining us, Victor.
Good morning, Jeff.
The Director of Campus Public Safety is Fred Creek. Welcome, Fred.
Good morning.
And Jody Waters, the Associate Provost and Director of Graduate Studies. Thank you, Jody.
Thank you, Jeff.
So we just started talking a few moments ago about there is a crisis management team at Southern Oregon University, of which you're a fraction, a quarter or something like that. But so let me hear first what the general response is when something happens at an educational institution not terribly far away. And I have to assume at least a few students at SOU are students who once attended UCC. So what are some of the first steps you do as a crisis management team?
Well, Jeff, the first thing we do is collect our team together and do an assessment on what exactly is going on and make sure we have the right information. And then our goal at that point is to reassess what our risks are on our campus and then supply our community with the resources that they may need, for example, counseling services, or like at 3 o'clock yesterday, we had a group session where we brought everybody together with professions and just talked about the situation and went over different resources available on campus to help them through this time.
And Jody, am I right about that? Or did we take a look at the roles and figure out if there are some UCC students who had then they're going to finish their education at SOU? Or
we actually didn't, no. I mean, our main priority when we first got the news was to make sure that we disseminated information to our community and to the community at large about whether or not SOU was included in the risk and what our response was going to be. It's difficult for us to go through that data quickly to learn if we have feeder students coming from or going to UCC. And the main concern is to look at the students that we have on campus, the members of the community, and what information they may need.
Were there contacts made, for example, to counseling services, Victor Chang?
Yes, we actually had a few people as soon as they heard the news because they either had friends or family members in Roseburg, they're from Roseburg, or maybe they were students who had attended UCC who were directly affected or, you know, just really distressed. So they were able to present to the health center, and we provide that walk-in availability to any students who are in distress.
Okay. Joe Lieberman, I want to bring you into this conversation now because you've written a couple of books now on school shootings. Let's get a genesis from you about what the original interest was to prod you to write these books.
Well, because I moved to Oregon, I'd been living in Japan, which is a gun-free, pretty much, country, and I moved here in 99, so that's 1 year after the Kip Kinkle shooting at Thurston High. I kept running into people who had some interface with that incident, and it just led to the writing of a book about that, and that stretched into how those shootings relate to other shootings prior to and after the Kip Kinkle shooting in Thurston High at Springfield.
So I'm curious to know about your own personal response. Obviously there's a huge amount of news media available after any kind of incident like this, and it's in your case 75 miles away from where you live. Do you tend to try to avoid the coverage when it happens, or are you drawn to it like moth to flame and just need to know more?
Immediately for me, although the book is published, it's out there, every new shooting adds information to let me determine what kind of trends are going on and where this is going, because it's always morphing. It's kind of like a virus that keeps morphing into different forms. And so the first thing I do is, out of the scant information that we're given, try to figure out what connects with previous shootings and, what's going on here that we can sort of make some conclusions about. And there were several things about this shooting that immediately struck me because of previous shootings. In the book, I list over 300 school shootings in detail, and so I had to get into, you know, why each one may have been motivated to do it. And I'm seeing some of those trends here as well.
And what were some of the similarities you saw here?
Well, the first thing that seemed a little different from some of the other more famous school shootings was the fact that, Christians were seemingly targeted, that seems to be verified from a number of witness accounts. But this isn't the first time that's happened, and I don't know if listeners recall that in Columbine, those two boys, Klebold and Harris, asked some of the students, "Do you believe in God?" The same thing happened with Jeff Weiss, March 2005, at the Red Lake, Minnesota Indian Reservation. And he asked people, "Do you believe in God?" as well. So it's not exactly, "Are you Christian?" but a similar sort of thing. That, and then, of course, Sung-Hui Cho at Virginia Tech had been brought up in a Christian family, but he also, in his diatribe that went to the news media, spoke about himself being almost like a second coming of Christ, and that he was the victim, and so he had no choice but to punish other people for not accepting him as he was.
All right, a lot to talk about here, and much more time in which to do it in this hour of the Jefferson Exchange. Joseph Lieberman is the author of a couple of books on school shootings. Victor Chang is the director of counseling at Southern Oregon University. Fred Creek, the director of campus public safety at SOU, and Jody Waters, the associate provost and director of graduate studies at SOU. You can join our discussion here on the Jefferson Exchange, 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Paul in Grants Pass, welcome back to the Jefferson Exchange.
Good morning. My heart goes out to the family and friends of all of those people who were killed and injured. The school shooting aspect of this is certainly there. As I understand it, this fellow is a recent transplant to the area from California. But in this instance, when you're talking about Kip Kinkle, you're talking about a child under the age of majority. Here we're talking about, a 23 to 26-year-old person. And I honestly don't know what we're going to do to stop these kinds of events short of an absolute ban on weapons. With many of the other situations, if it turns out that he was not allowed to have a weapon, then we need to hold the people who are providing them weapons, either through negligence or through some act of actual commission, we need to hold those people equally accountable for the actions of the individuals who set off the weapons. The other alternative is to just ignore this and just start calling it a cost of doing business in American society.
All right. That's a thought to leave us with. Thanks for that, Paul. Appreciate it. Thoughts from around the table. Let's start with you at Public Safety, Fred Creek. I mean, when we talk about trying to make sure that we keep guns out of people's hands who shouldn't have them, that's a tricky thing to do. Then we're also talking about an open society and open campuses. I mean, it's not like you want to put fences around a place like Southern Oregon University. So what are some of the things that have happened in recent years to beef up security? And then what are the things you see down the road?
Well, Jeff, I think it all realms in training on how to respond to these situations and having our faculty, staff, and students prepared so if something like this happens, and having our rules in place where we have a no weapon policy on campus.
And so I'm curious to know, Victor, about the kinds of things you mentioned that people from the Roseburg area were seeking you out, but just were there other people seeking out counseling services at SOU who just needed to talk to somebody because they'd heard it happen too many times before, and here they are on a college campus and they're feeling vulnerable?
We expect to have some folks like that come in. Obviously, we see these unfortunate incidents, tragic incidents on the news, and yet there's this thing like, oh, it couldn't happen here. And so Roseburg is pretty close to home. And so even for those who are not directly affected, the shock and surprise that something like that could happen in Southern Oregon, I think it affects people and really distresses them and makes them question their safety. So we expect to have more people like that come in and maybe seek out our services. We also hope that they are leaning on the comfort and support of their friends and family. It was a really nice message that President Saigo delivered yesterday afternoon in which he said, reach out to your family. Let them know that you're okay. Make that connection. That's so important in these times especially.
Can you expand just a little bit, Jody Waters, on what President Saigo's message was?
Yeah, I think that he had issued a couple of messages, one via Facebook and then one to the community via email, and one at the event yesterday. And the one that Victor's referring to is the one at the event yesterday in which he noted that for a lot of us, we really seek to understand this within the framework of our own families or our own spheres of connection. And he reflected a little bit personally on ways in which and times in which he has felt vulnerable as a member of a campus community. And I think that that was a great act of empathy to reach out and really, Victor had made this clear also, really allow people to just hold their grief, their pain, their sense of vulnerability, because we're all affected by this. And I think that that's a really powerful message, to not give permission, but to certainly validate the feelings that we have, because they're all correct. They all matter. They're all our perceptions. And that was part of what President Saigo had wanted to convey to the community that gathered yesterday as well. Part of what he had also wanted to do was reassure that the systems that we have at SOU are in place and remain in place, and they're fairly extensive. We're really proud of them. They work well. And so that was part of the message to the community in the various ways that he reached out.
I should get the first name in here. We are talking about Roy Saigo, the president of Southern Oregon University.
Yes.
And piggybacking on that, the other thing we do in terms of prevention here, so Joe Lieberman mentioned Sungmin Cho and the shooting at Virginia Tech in 2007. We have really learned a lot since then. One of the key learnings, unfortunate learnings that came out of that incident, was there were different pieces of information that were known to different entities both on and off campus. And that was not collected and centralized in one place. And perhaps if that information had been, we can't say in hindsight what would have happened in terms of preventative measures. But certainly we know, and you know, the people who've done the reporting in Virginia have seen that, you know, there were pieces of information that were not connected. And so what we have learned in both the higher education community and certainly have put in place in SOU is we have a team that responds to reports from students, staff, faculty, family members, and community to triangulate all that information and assess risk. We do that via an online CARES report, which is an online system that any community member can access, any student, staff, faculty person can access. And it goes to a central office, our Office of Student Support and Intervention, that really is the central place and a place where we can triage all that information together and make a better evaluation of risk on campus.
But how well-staffed is that office? I mean, when I think about trying to take on extra things in addition to what you're already doing, and I know how thinly staffed universities can be, certainly state universities in this day and age, I just wonder if you have people who are dedicated to just doing that, who are in a position to jump and drop everything else.
There are people who that is one of their primary functions, and we are going to also increase resources in that office. Not based on this incident that was already in place.
I think one of the other, and I really appreciate you asking that question, because I suspect a lot of folks are right now wondering what we have in place and whether or not we're adequately prepared. One of the real strengths of our system is it's the extensive partnership that we have across all facets of campus. Faculty are the partners, students are partners, staff. So that system draws information from every corner of campus, and they range. We've seen just in the past couple of years, particularly in the last year, a really significant increase in the number of reports that are coming forward, really a huge increase. And we view that not with alarm, but with a great deal of comfort that folks are keeping an eye out for one another, that they are, you know, not scared to step forward and say, I'm not sure if this is something that we ought to be concerned about, but to let somebody know. So while the staffing to respond is always paramount for us, we also have a lot of foundations and a lot of folks holding the responsibility to do that and taking that responsibility seriously. And that's, I think, a really big part of it as well.
Jody Waters is the Associate Provost at Southern Oregon University. Fred Creek, the Director of Campus Public Safety. Victor Chang, the Director of Counseling. And on the phone from Eugene is Joseph Lieberman, the author of School Shootings and the Shooting Game. You can join our discussion on the Jefferson Exchange, 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So given the sensitivity to information that comes across, there is this thing it's really tangential to Southern Oregon University, but it involved Ashland High School, which is across the street from Southern Oregon University. Fred, can you kind of walk us through what Ashland High School went through yesterday with Ashland Police and some decisions that were made?
Well, again, it's Ashland Police Department is a part of our system as well. We have such a great relationship with them that when things happen in the city, they inform of us what's going on, because we're required by Clery to notify our community if something's happened in the community. And so when things like this develop, they know the need for us to have the information and to send the information out to our community and let them know what's going on. We have great confidence in the police department here and the way that they deal with situations. And working with the high school, I was brought into that initial briefing on what was going on. It was really assuring to me of the collaboration that went on between the police department and the high school and the university on dealing with the situation and having the outcome that it was, where nothing actually happened.
So you talk to each other is the important thing. In
absolutely.
Cases where in years past that might not have happened.
Yeah, absolutely.
And essentially what happened was there was an email, I understand, from a former resident of Ashland who included screenshots of a former high school student's Facebook page displaying a firearm with some statements that were seen as either alarming or threatening. And then from that point, between school officials and Ashland City Police, the decision was made to cancel the homecoming parade set for yesterday. And they also, I guess, released students 10 minutes late after some lockdown procedures. Is this the understanding you have, Fred?
That is the understanding from the news release from the police department.
Okay. And so you felt obliged to put something out on to Southern Oregon University as well, just to let people know this had happened?
Well, it's not obliged to feel that way. We're required by law to do that. When there's something that's that close to our university, we have to inform our community, and it's referred to as a timely notification.
Okay. Just to let people know this happened.
Absolutely.
But also say there's no cause for alarm.
That's right.
All right. A bunch of more calls waiting here. Let's go to Derek in Talent. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I'm glad to hear the discussion about preventative measures and things of that nature. It's just strange. I call as a defender of the Bill of Rights and all rights, recognizing, of course, that our rights aren't absolute. I can't go into a crowded theater and yell fire, so my speech is limited there, just like I expect my Second Amendment rights to be limited in some way, and I know that the discussion will lean heavy on that. I just hope that I hope that the discussion continues to focus on preventative measures and mental health discussions. And I guess maybe this is more for Joe, but anybody wants to chime in, that'd be great. I think of Bowling for Columbine and Michael Moore's sort of idea that he compared Canada and the U.S. and the amount of guns and the access to the same culture and determined that the, quote, culture of fear was to blame in this country for our gun violence. And I guess I'm sitting here thinking about the culture of fear and then our reactions to this. I almost wonder if we're in some sort of vicious cycle. I certainly don't have the solution, but it's bizarre that that a guy, frantic man in Medford, is banging on someone's door a couple years ago and an old man opens the door and shoots him in the chest. I mean, that's where we're at. And so I guess I'd just like some thoughts on the culture of fear rather than Christian faith being maybe the culprit.
All right. Thanks for that, Derek. Appreciate that. I must admit that watching Bowling for Columbine myself while I was still working in TV, and there was quite an indictment of how horrible things look when you watch TV in America versus what shows up on the local news in Canada. It was an interesting feeling. Joe Lieberman, this is more or less directed at you in the beginning. You want to take a stab at what Derek is talking about?
And definitely that culture of fear is something I examined in a whole chapter in the book. I was very impressed by Michael Moore's Bowling for Columbine. And one of the statements that came out of that, if having more guns made us safer, America would be the safest country in the world. Now, I was coming, again, out of 18 years in Japan, which doesn't have that culture at all, even though, bad things sometimes happen. So one of the biggest culture shocks for me was when I returned to the U.S. and living in Oregon, how easily accessible guns were, how seemed to be almost no limits on who could possess them or buy them. And I certainly agree that that's the direction that we should look at, but media, certain types of media, really play these things up, and the aspect of fame is one of the most important parts of this particular story of what happened yesterday. I don't know if you've seen some of the social media things that this fellow purportedly wrote?
I have heard about some of them.
Okay, well...
references to, in particular, the shooter in Virginia.
Exactly.
A few weeks ago, yeah.
Right, and he's saying, you know, I've noticed the more people... somebody who's unknown suddenly becomes world famous, the whole world knows who they are, the more people you kill, the more you're in the limelight. And remember, every one of these school shooters, whether they're a high school student shooting their peers or somebody older who walks into a school such as what happened in Connecticut, and these people are similar ages, actually, in their 20s, the one thing that connects them all is they're all suicidal. So if you have somebody who's suicidal, they don't want to be anonymous and just kill themselves in a lonely death. They want to take people with them, and most of all, they want to be famous for it. If they can't get fame in a good way, they want to be infamous, and that seems to be definitely part of the aim that what happened here yesterday.
You know, I noticed last night that the Douglas County Sheriff, John Hanlon, was saying, you're never going to hear me say the shooter's name. Chris Harper Mercer, they haven't confirmed it directly from the sheriff's office, but back channels have indicated the shooter's name was Chris Harper Mercer, 26 years old, lived in Winchester nearby to UCC. You know, I didn't quite understand the sheriff's comment about you're not going to hear me say the shooter's name. And then I saw the social media stuff by Chris Harper Mercer referencing the shooter in Virginia by name, just what Joe was talking about. And do we create more? I mean, is that a concern, a genuine concern of law enforcement, Fred Creek?
Yeah, it sure is. I mean, sensationalizing these kind of situations and, you know, with the mass media getting this word out on what he did, it plants the seed. It plants the mindset. But I really want to focus in on something that was said about we have the tools, we have the information before us, and we have to train our community what to do when these people reach out and say, these bad things are going to happen, or I'm going to do these bad things. And I think that's where we need to focus. We need to focus on being able to get that information to the right people so that we can intervene and prevent these things from happening.
When people are reaching out, I mean, when the people themselves are reaching out asking for help, or when people are saying these people appear to need help, or both?
Both, absolutely. We need to be able to decipher that information and get the right help to them so that these kind of type of situations don't happen.
Jody Waters?
Yeah, I want to piggyback on that a little bit, because we frequently hear the adjective senseless attached to these acts and these events, and I'm going to look to my colleagues in mental health to confirm this, but my suspicion, my knowledge from the research that's done is that we need to get comfortable with the idea that there are a lot of folks for whom these acts actually do make sense, and they make a great deal of sense. And that belief informs how they act and how they interact with others, and that's part of what we need to recognize and acknowledge and be willing to step forward and notice. Mm-hmm. And so I really agree with what Fred is saying there.
All right, I want to bring Victor into this as well, but after a short break, we need to take one now. This is the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking about the aftermath of the Umpqua Community College shootings. We'll come back to the Jefferson Exchange with our guests and your phone calls and emails in 1 minute. It's 8:36 on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Reinley. Thank you for listening. We've made a few changes today in light of the shooting at Umpqua Community College that killed 10 people yesterday and wounded at least 7 others. The dead include the suspected shooter, Chris Harper Mercer, that name confirmed through several back channels, but we've already talked about the Douglas County Sheriff, says he will not say the name of the shooter. We have 4 guests with us in the studio, one on the phone. Joseph Lieberman is the author of 2 books about school shootings. He's on the line from Eugene. From Southern Oregon University, we have Jody Waters, the Associate Provost, Fred Creek, the Director of Campus Public Safety, and Victor Chang, the Director of Counseling. There will be a First Friday Art segment at 9 o'clock. You can join this discussion here and now at 800-838-3760 by phone or by email jx@jeffnet.org. Jody had just broached the subject of the worldview of shooters and the things. These things make sense to the people who do them. And so, Victor, I wonder if you can kind of let us know what kind of training there is out there, or what we do to put the pieces together to recognize when people are starting to move down these avenues.
Right. So, unfortunately, there's been increasingly a field that's devoted to threat assessment. It's really started with the Secret Service and other federal agencies back in the day who've, you know, had to look at shootings and assassination attempts on the president, stuff like that. We know that these individuals are really aggrieved they bear significant grievances, and however rational or irrational it may appear to someone else, it's something subjectively they feel, and they tend to be pretty isolated and go along a pathway of violence. So for many people, there's some ideation. There's some thinking about, oh, I want to do this, I want to do that. Maybe they fire off an angry letter or they're threatening a lawsuit, and they feel like, oh, that's not enough, I need to do more. And I would agree with Joe that for many of these folks, there's an element of suicidality. There's an, at some point, they pass a point of no return. There's an element of, I don't care if I die in doing this. I'm so miserable, and I'm going to take other people out with me. But the thoughts might then go towards planning. You know, when you look at a lot of these events, most of them have to be planned to some extent, and sometimes extensively for a year or two or more. There's means acquisition, you know, getting weapons, planning, like I mentioned. Sometimes there's often some sort of behavior or rehearsal, like going to the place where this shooting might take place. All along these ways, all along that pathway, we know that sometimes people leak information, and that's what Fred was referring to, is, you know, they almost can't help but, you know, leak it a little bit in writing, and increasingly writing online. In this particular instance, it looks like it was a fairly anonymous posting, so it may have been hard to pull that information to be credible and usable in a timely way. But maybe to saying something to friends or last minute warnings and things like that, sometimes those things leak out. And like I said, at some point, shooters will pass a point of no return where they commit themselves to this violent act. And sometimes they might have a date in mind, you know, that's significant. We look at we learned a lot about that from the shooter down in UC Santa Barbara, who sort of kept an extensive journal about his planning process and thought process through that. I do want to mention that there is a thing about means restriction and means reduction. When we look at violent death in this country, actually, there's been news media that have covered President Obama's remarks about comparing deaths from terrorism to deaths from gun violence. It's staggering how many deaths by gun we have in this country, the vast majority of which are actually suicide deaths. So when we look at public health research looking at suicide as a preventable thing, we know that there's strong correlation, so not causation, but correlation with places where there's increased access to guns, there is more death by guns, whether that's accidental or suicide. Homicide is in there as well, but really, you know, I wish the media had, you know, reported yesterday that of those violent gun deaths, you know, so many of them are by suicide, actually.
All right. Good point to bring up. Joe Lieberman, do you find any appreciable differences in your research between people who would shoot up an elementary or high school versus somebody who would shoot up, in this case, a college campus?
Yeah, I mean, the motivation in a high school is often tied to a perception of being bullied. I want to get back at the people who hurt me. And, you know, they aim it at some specific individuals, but then it just spreads to the entire school community. The thing that carries through all of these is that the person is never saying, I am responsible for my own happiness or my own life. It's always to blame others for what's going wrong in my life. So when you get somebody a little bit older, and in this case, I'm not sure whether this fellow, Chris Mercer, attended this school or not. I'm not sure if we're being told that. But I would think it's likely he had some kind of interface with the school.
Live nearby, certainly, but beyond that, I'm getting blank faces around this table, too. It looks okay. Like none of us are sure at this point.
Well, the thing is, the school represents the place where the most drama occurs in a young person's life, and that's the center of existence for many people. As you get older, that's not as true, but then there's workplace shootings, there's mall shootings, and they all have some kind of a tie-in together with the person perceiving the society has wronged me. I have a right to get back at them. And this particular fellow, Chris Mercer, actually said, according to somebody who witnessed it before shooting a teacher, I've been waiting to do this for years. And also the fact that people who knew him as far back as California said he was constantly wearing camouflage pants, military style, in their own minds, and this goes back to what one of your other guests was saying, you know, this justification for what they're doing, they're kind of their own hero in a sort of video game they're playing, you know, against the world, that they are righting wrongs, they are justified in doing this because society has been, you know, bad to them. They can be hit society at the most vulnerable point, the most innocent people, which is why an older person might go to an elementary school. So I think that definitely ties in.
All right. More calls here to take. Mark in Reading, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking about yesterday's UCC shooting with Joseph Lieberman, Victor Chang, Fred Creek, and Jody Waters.
Good morning.
Hi.
This morning on the BBC, here on this program, on this station, they had an excerpt from an interview with the father of the shooter, who was British, they said, and that his son was also British. And I'm wondering if this is the first time that it's a person not born in the United States that did this kind of thing, and what, if any, relevance it might have that he was born outside of the country.
All right, I'll put that to Joe Lieberman. Thanks for that, Mark. Appreciate it. Joe, any knowledge of that?
Oh, well, it's certainly not the first time someone not born in the U.S. Just think of Virginia Tech, and Sung Hui Cho was born in South Korea. But there's been quite a few others. I think he came here evidently as a child and grew up mostly in California, so I don't know that that's terribly relevant. Maybe the fact of the parents separated or divorced, I'm not sure which, has a bit more relevance. Also, in his postings, there was something about background and his own beliefs, and that ties into it as well. But being foreign-born, I don't think is a large part of this.
All right. Well, let's go take a call from Ann and Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you. So, right-wing talk radio and Fox News spout hate and divisiveness and paranoia 24 hours a day. We have Republicans in legislatures and Congress that do everything they can to block any kind of effective gun control. They also go all the way out keeping taxes low so that there isn't sufficient funds for adequate mental health care and outreach. So I think there's a political dimension here that people are absolutely ignoring, and I would like to hear what your panelists have to say about that.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you, Anne. Appreciate that. Okay, who among the panel wants to jump in on that one? All right. 10-foot pole here. Joe Lieberman, any thoughts on the political dimension of it?
Well, yeah. I mean, coming back into this country, I'm born American. I spent most of my life here, but I spent a lot of years overseas. So I got a different objective point of view coming into the society. And definitely, you know, I noticed that in the media, especially right-wing media, especially cable news, you're going to sell more commercials, you're going to have people watching more intensely the more you emphasize, you know, the fear factor. And it's been proven that when people are afraid, they are more open to suggestion, whether it's politically who they'll vote for or products they'll purchase because they see a commercial tied in with it. So there's that aspect of it, and I definitely would agree with this woman caller.
When we talk about ways to work prevention a little better, it seems like it often comes down to there will be greater restrictions on somebody for something. When we talk about people who really should have been committed, for example, to a mental health facility, well, now you're talking about restricting their behavior. If you're talking about gaining more access to people's social media stuff, you're talking about restricting their privacy. If you're talking about putting greater restrictions on guns, you're talking about restrictions there. Can we, in the society we have, for the folks in this room, deal with what we've got with the tools at hand, or do we need to place some greater restrictions, particularly with on college campuses? Jody Waters, I'm going to go to you for that one.
Well, I'm probably not itching to be the person to suggest more restrictions on folks' rights in a public venue like this. I think speaking as a representative of an institution, it's a really fine line. I mean, on one hand, we have a huge responsibility for the safety of our community. I think part of what we haven't referred to is the fact that it's a venue within which ideas are stock and trade. They're freely available, and we construct it to be a safe space within which safety allows folks to speak their minds, refer to their own beliefs, and increasingly, I think, their own experiences, which creates massive potential for triggering words and events and activities. And yet, no, I wouldn't argue that we have any real I don't know if I want to use the word obligation or responsibility. I don't think we have tools to delimit that in a powerful and meaningful way. Without,
I mean, we're not, for example, going to start building large walls around college
right.
campuses and requiring, you know, pinching down the access points.
Exactly, or the access points that may be triggered by the way we interact with one another. And I think that those are both equally viable to look at in terms of what kind of society we have and the question about whether or not we have the tools. So, you know, that's a really difficult question. And I will say personally, I'm listening to the comparisons between the U.S. and Canada with some interest because I am Canadian and we frequently hear this construct around the difference in the culture, and I think that's probably true. But on the other hand, I think that when we refer to the media and we refer to the tools that we have, we frequently look at the individual. We look at things like party affiliation and political views and other things like that, and that's the construct that comes from both, if you want to simplify it to the extent of both sides of the media, that focuses on primarily on the individual, and the individual is aberrant, the individual is the deviant, the individual is the responsible party. Where I do think we have some tools is to take a look at the system, to take a look at what is a systemic environment that propels activities of this kind of nature. And that's where I feel like we have a larger responsibility, and universities and other institutions of learning are probably as good a place as any for that to come forward.
Absolutely. I would agree. There is a sociological perspective to this and frankly, a legislative one as well. And I won't comment any further on that. But I will say another piece of data that we are aware of is we know that the rate of suicide for college students is half that than their non-college attending peers. And there may be multiple factors to that. There's no one causational piece of data that we're aware of.
So more suicides and, for people not going to college, is that what you said?
About twice the rate. And but one of the things we suspect pretty strongly is that by and large most colleges in this country ban weapons on their campus, and we know that guns are the most lethal attempt method. And so there is some pretty strong data that suggests, you know, among suicidologists who study this, that means restriction on college campuses does lower the risk for suicide. So
okay.
We know that, and we know that attending college is a privilege, and we have a community, and we have a student code of conduct and community standards that we abide by, that while we do not infringe on other people's rights, we hold maybe our students to a higher standard and to a higher sense of safety and conduct. And that, I think, is also preventative.
Okay. Means restriction. You've identified a valuable new term for us here today. Fred Krieg, I want to come to you, though, because as we talk about things that we can do within the existing structure, it seems like that's already being done in law enforcement, that you guys have figured out new ways to talk across department lines in ways that didn't happen maybe 15 years ago.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm new to the university. I've been here a little over 6 months, and I am just totally impressed with how law enforcement in the Valley have such an open communication. We have monthly meetings, and there's a lot of collaboration. And so it's an open book. When challenges are made, it's not made in silos. You know, we look at them from a holistic view of how it affects the community and the city next to each other. And the university is a big part of that. And so we're invited to the table and get to have those discussions and chime in on effects and causations.
And in fact, we haven't had a chance to talk to the Medford Police about it yet, but they've apparently made some great strides in law enforcement through the use of their Facebook page, people contributing a lot of information through social media. More calls here. Jim in Grants Pass, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Yes. This is one comment that I've had when these things happen. We're still in a, we hope it won't happen, if it happens, and we talk about first responders. It seems to me like the first responders should always be in the when it's going to happen, not if it's going to happen, preparedness. It reminds me of parents with three little girls, 7, 9, and 11 years old. We hope none of them get pregnant, if one of them, but they are not preparing for when one of them becomes pregnant. I don't want to be blunt, but it's you have to jump from the from the hope right to the preparing for when something's going to happen.
Okay, interesting viewpoint for that, Jim. Thanks. Victor, I saw a hand go up. Everybody's pointing at Fred.
Absolutely, because that is our philosophy. It's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when. And that's how we train, that's how we look at it, and that's the approach that we take.
All right, more calls here. Let's go to Brett in Ashland. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Yeah, thank you. For years now, we've had the Second Amendment used on us by people who say our right to have a gun shall not be infringed. But a right to have something is also paired with a responsibility to do it well. And what I would like to do is turn the Second Amendment around and use it back on them and talk about the first half of it, where it says a well-regulated militia being necessary and so forth. I'd like to ask the question, where is the well-regulated part of this in our country? Right. When are we going to honor the Second Amendment by having a well-regulated militia?
All right.
Thank you.
Thanks for that. Anybody want to address that? Joe Lieberman, is this something you have talked about a lot in your books?
Second Amendment comes into it. I guess when I thought of well-regulated militia, I thought of the National Guard. We do have that. And I think as far as campuses, I think, a lot of them have put in plans. I know here in Eugene, an assistant principal named Mike Johnson at Sheldon High School, where my daughter attended, because of the book, reading the book, he initiated drills that actually stopped a shooter that got onto the campus. Now that some of the teachers and other staff were a little bit annoyed by these monthly drills, but it was definitely a matter of when, not if, and it worked when the time came. So people are out there who are planning for these things, knowing that it's definitely something that can happen.
All right, an email here from Joe in Talent. He says, on this sad day here in Oregon, it has become painfully clear that we can no longer look to our representatives to do anything about gun violence other than mouth-empty offers of sorrow and equally empty promises to do something. The only way things will change is when someone on the executive board of the NRA or a Republican politician in Washington, God forbid, loses a child or a family member in one of these mass murders. Until it rips their lives apart, we will continue to repeat the same cycle of horrific violence followed by gun lobby talking points flooding the media, followed by political positioning, and then some distraction that takes us off point. If insanity is the act of doing the same thing over and over again, thinking the outcome will change, then we are truly an insane society. My heart goes out to the families in Medford. So says Joe in Talent. Eli in Medford, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. Eli, you there?
Next hour.
Pardon me?
Is this going to carry over into the next hour?
No, we're going to stop in just about 2 minutes.
Yeah, well, I wish I had more time. I think this is a pretty good example of... We already have a restriction that is causing the problem, and that is that was a gun-free area. It's pretty obvious that if one person had been surrounded by, a couple dozen armed people who were in a position to defend themselves, that they would not have gotten as far as they did. And that's because of we already have these restrictions. And
so more guns, more people able to defend themselves is your point.
Exactly. And right. And to the point that other guy just made, it's like he's saying, yeah, we have to have more restrictions, but that's already the cause of the problem here.
All right. Thank you, Eli. I appreciate it. So, Fred Creek, just describe it from a law enforcement perspective. Does it seem to be a better thing to have a room full of people with guns ready for the person who comes into the room ready to fire a gun?
I discuss this in my training when I have with people is that it goes back to the, are you trained? Do you know how to use that? Because we don't want to have a bunch of untrained people just throwing rounds down range. You never know who they're going to hit. Even trained law enforcement, the statistics are very low. And when they get into a situation and use their firearm, that it's very low on their accuracy. So having that said, it's not the best choice. The best choice is the preventive measures that we discussed about. Having a community of reporting like we have here at SOU and being able to deal with those situations when they come in.
All right. Another call from Nicole in Ashland. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Good morning. I had a question for Victor Chang. I was wondering if he would be able to comment. There are a lot of articles right now that can be found on the Internet that say that, again, while correlation doesn't necessarily equal causation, most of these mass shootings have something in common, and that is that the perpetrators are on or are withdrawing from psychiatric medications like Prozac, Zoloft, Wellbutrin. Curious if you have any comments about that.
All right. Thank you very much for that, Nicole. Victor, any knowledge of that?
I don't have knowledge whether most of. I think it's. I appreciate the opportunity to talk about mental health and mental illness and how does that interact or intersect with this issue. There's certainly a degree of pathology going on with this. I mean, there's. We can all say there's something not well with them, but I sometimes disagree with the conflating of mental illness because, first of all, when that's thrown around, whether people we need more funding for treatment or people just need more help, I just need to go on the air and say the vast majority of people with mental illness are not violent or not any more violent than the four of us sitting in this room. I do also agree with Joe, though. There's a segment of the shooters that are inherently suicidal and homicidal at the same time. Lastly, I'm not sure, you know, people withdrawing off psychiatric medications do have rebound effects, do have their symptoms come back and can come back strongly. That I don't know if we have time to really go into that, but that is an issue for prescribers and for patients to be aware of, for sure.
All right, many more issues ahead of us, none of which we'll solve in the few seconds we have left. I really want to thank our panel for coming in today. Joe Lieberman is the author of School Shootings and the Shooting Game on the phone in Eugene. Victor Chang, Director of Counseling at Southern Oregon University. Fred Creek, SOU's Director of Campus Public Safety. And Jody Waters, the Associate Provost and Director of Graduate Study. Thank you all for sharing perspectives on this sorry morning.
Thank you, Jeff.
Thank you for listening to the Jefferson Exchange today.